Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
This podcast features Dan Esty, Hill House Professor of Environmental Law and Policy at Yale Law School and the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Professor Esty will be discussing how businesses can develop solutions for environmental problems that bring benefits to themselves as well as the environment. Professor Esty, along with Andrew Winstead, are the authors of Green to Gold, How Smart Companies Use Environmental Strategy to Innovate, Create Value, and Build Competitive Advantage. Professor Esty is interviewed by Caitlin Thomas, Assistant Director of Public Affairs at Yale Law School.
Why is going green such a hot topic right now?
Well, I think what you see across society is a business world that has come to the conclusion that going green is essential to being competitive in the marketplace today. And that is driven by a public that is very eager to see a response to climate change, but also action on a variety of other issues. The public is very concerned about food safety. We have an ongoing series of scandals, most recently melamine-contaminated milk products, but over the course of the last year, poisoned toothpaste and poisoned dog food and lead-painted toys. So there's a great deal of concern about the supply chains that are bringing products to this country and concern about whether those are being monitored, particularly when they come out of the developing world. And I think the public has come to expect in our country that there is a structure of law, environmental law and broader food and health and safety law, that protects people from this kind of scandal. And we can't be confident of that where these supply chains are globalized. So there's a lot of concern both about the risks of a failure to respond to a certain set of issues, but frankly also about the opportunity. And I think this is why a number of businesses have now gotten very excited. There is a challenge to be faced with climate change, with availability of water, with water pollution, with air pollution, with exposure to chemicals and heavy metals. But I think what companies have come to understand is that if you address this issue set better than your competition, you are competitively advantaged. And there are also very real cost opportunities, that is to say, cost reduction opportunities, where a company, if it manages these issues well, will reduce its costs compared to the competition. And that's especially true with oil prices now at nearly $100 a barrel. So there's big potential payoffs from investments in what we call eco-efficiency, trying to ensure that buildings and distribution systems and really anywhere that energy is consumed is done better and done in a more efficient manner. So a lot of companies looking at ways to reduce costs, particularly energy costs, as an opportunity for competitive advantage. Companies looking at ways to reduce risks as a point of competitive advantage. And then perhaps the biggest kind of change in attitudes in the business world is a recognition by a number of smart companies that there are going to be opportunities to sell solutions to environmental problems. In a society that wants to find ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to limit the threat of climate change, and to address all of these other concerns ranging from water and air pollution to chemical exposures, that companies that can bring goods and services to the market that are solutions potentially will gain in a very big way. And I think beyond that, there are a number of companies that have come to believe that they need to build environmental sensitivity into their brand, that the public is interested in these issues. They want to be seen as leaders in helping society move forward on the environment. So I think the business world is very interested, building on a base of interest across the public. And frankly, it's also driven, this interest in environmental protection, in a change in policy attitudes. We've begun to really shift, I think, dramatically toward a new approach to environmental regulation, not the old model of command and control mandates, where the government not only sets a standard that has to be complied with, but in many cases dictates the very technology that a producer has to deploy, a particular kind of scrubber on a smokestack or filter on a pipeline. And the problem with that model is that it doesn't give much room for flexibility, doesn't give much room for creativity. And I think we're evolving now towards a new approach that relies much more on economic incentives, or what we sometimes call market mechanisms. And in that new approach, the government tells you how much you pay for the harm you cause. And that really creates a logic for business of trying to think about what they're doing and to try and reduce their emissions. Reduced emissions translates into reduced costs in this model. It also creates a very important incentive for innovation. because then you have every company in the world thinking about how to bring its emissions down. And frankly, the ones that come up with the very best solutions solve not only their own problem, but sell their solution to everyone else. So I think it's this interplay of public interest, changing business attitudes, and a new approach to law and policy that have all three together driven us toward a recognition that there's big opportunities in the environmental arena.
Can you talk a little bit about why the private sector is so important? What exactly makes the private sector so powerful?
Sure. I think one of the things that we've come to understand in a world that centers on the need for innovation as the way forward in the environmental arena, and I say innovation meaning both policy innovation, but also technology development. So it's really fresh thinking about old problems that's required. And it turns out that the business world is really better at the technology development aspect of this than government. So the old model where you've got a bunch of smart people, a couple of thousand smart people at the EPA thinking about what the best available technology might be for a particular industry, and that's the term of art in the law, best available technology. But if the EPA smart folks are thinking about it, you've got a limited number of people, a couple of thousand at best. If you shift the burden onto the private sector to think about what the best path forward is, suddenly it's not a couple of thousand, but rather a couple of hundred thousand, or in some industries, a couple of million people who are engaged in that search for solutions. And the key to innovation turns out to be around two dimensions. One is the scale of effort. So moving from a few thousand to a few hundred thousand searchers for solutions is a big deal. And the other is diversity. You really want to think about the problem from the widest range of possible perspectives. And one of the challenges in government is there's often a culture within the government that narrows vision, whereas when you throw it to the private sector, people come at it from hundreds of different points of view, and that diversity enriches the search for innovation. Now let me add to that that it turns out that the private sector is also willing to take risks that the government often won't. If the government official is told that there's a potential innovation, but the chances are only 1 in 10 that it's going to pay off, they shy away. But in the venture capital world that is actually funding a lot of this investment in technology development, a 1 in 10 chance of payoff is fine. That's the model they work with. And they do so well with the 1 in 10 that wins that they can afford 9 in 10 not working out. So I think the willingness to take risk, the willingness to invest a large amount of money, because it turns out the government can't put enough money into this. The government might spend a few million, or if we get really ambitious, a few billion. But over the last year, more than $100 billion of private capital has flowed into the so-called clean tech arena. So the scale of the private sector's capacity is just much greater than government. And frankly, the private sector rewards success in a way that the government has a hard time doing. So all of this leads us to a new model where the private sector is at the heart of the innovation process.
In your book, Green to Gold, you talk about some specific examples of companies that have been very successful. Can you talk a little bit about some of those examples?
Sure. One of the exciting things in this move towards an innovation-focused approach to environmental protection is that it creates opportunities for companies of all sizes and types. So some of the most creative work is startup companies where an innovator, you know, is got an idea, gets some backing from a venture capital fund, and is able to test it out and see whether he or she can produce a new technology that's going to break through. And we've got hundreds of little companies, for example, in the alternative energy arena that are trying out lots of different ideas. In fact, going way beyond the things that get focus, wind power and solar power. We have people trying out wave power and tidal power and ocean current power. And some people even working with algae to see if they can extract a fuel. And other people are working with second generation biofuels beyond corn-based ethanol, which we all know is a problem, but are looking at prairie grass or agricultural waste that might have some cellulosic potential that we can extract a fuel source from. And then at the other end of the scale, some of our very biggest companies in the country have decided they need to reposition themselves as environmental goods and services providers. So just down the road from where we sit in New Haven, General Electric has become a very substantial investor in environmental solutions. Jeff Immelt, who took over a few years ago as CEO, has launched this Eco-Imagination campaign that provides a high profile to his company's very fuel-efficient locomotives, high-efficiency jet engines, He's taken some of the turbine technology and the smart engineers working on the jet engines and turned it into a wind power business. He has a solar power business, a clean water business. And let me be very clear, Jeff Immelt is not doing this because he's secretly a member of the Sierra Club. This is being done because he sees high growth, high margin opportunities for these businesses and sees them as the key to a successful GE future. And of course, just up the road from New Haven in Hartford, United Technologies is also become a big innovator in the environmental arena. George David, who just retired as CEO there, really drove the company into becoming a very big player in terms of fuel-efficient heating and air conditioning, whole sets of innovations around how to make elevators draw less electricity for his Otis subsidiary, and has really begun to rethink how buildings work with a much greater focus on squeezing out energy cost and at the same time, of course, reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Given all of that, what do you think the government's role should be? What can the government do?
So let me be very clear. When I say the government shouldn't be doing the technology development, it doesn't mean the government goes away. To the contrary, the government has to be all the more clever in structuring incentives to engage the private sector in this innovation process. So there really needs to be a carefully thought through, probably portfolio of incentives created that draw the business community into the search for solutions, that engage the venture capital community, that get the private equity investors to pour money into this arena as opposed to other places they might spend their money, and really inspires the inventors across our society, the creative spirits that exist really across the United States and around the world, to focus their time and talent on the environment and related energy challenges as opposed to inventing the next video game or working on some second generation dot-com company.
What do you see as the biggest environmental or sustainability issue facing the new administration?
Well, I think we have a whole series of issues that are going to have to be addressed by the new president. And frankly, there has been such a slow pace of progress across the spectrum of environmental challenges over the last decade that we are going to have a president with a multi-pronged agenda. But I think climate change probably looms largest. It has such a broad impact, really involving decisions made by every company across our society, and for that matter, every individual and household, that we're all going to have to step up and play a role, and the government's going to have to structure a regulatory system that gets all of us to pay attention to our greenhouse gas emissions, promotes energy efficiency and reduced emissions from fossil fuel burning, and also provides a real logic for us to invest in alternative energy so that we can move forward and get beyond the fossil fuel place that we are now.
How do you think that the current economic climate is going to impact these issues?
Well, one of the sort of traditional thoughts is that somehow there's a trade-off between economic progress and environmental investments. And it turns out that it may be actually that they work together, that the push toward a clean energy future and an attempt to really bring down greenhouse gas emissions might be one of the engines that restores us to economic strength. Certainly, there's a big payoff for investments in energy efficiency. When we improve the lighting and the heating and the air conditioning and buy better windows that reduce the amount of energy consumed in a house or in a building, there's a payoff in terms of reduced cost. So a lot of companies are investing, particularly in the energy efficiency opportunities, as a way to make themselves leaner and more competitive. The same actual logic applies at the household level. When budgets are tight, it's even a very good time to invest in energy efficiency to bring down family costs. So I think there's going to be a lot of that done. And more broadly, I think there is a big opportunity to drive towards a clean energy future as an element of economic progress.
This is probably the million-dollar question. How do we extract ourselves from fossil fuels?
Well, I think there is good news and there's bad news with regard to the challenge of trying to get beyond fossil fuels. The bad news is we've been at this fossil fuel approach to our energy structure of society for a very long time. In fact, I think it was Benjamin Silliman who first got us going on an oil-based economy 150 years ago. And it's going to take a good bit of time to rebuild the infrastructure on which our society and the entire economy is built. And that does require a broad base of incentives and really some transformative thinking to go beyond where we are now. Now, I think the good news is I believe that the public is ready for change in a big way. I think the public is very frustrated by the war in Iraq, And more broadly believes that the Middle East is a complicated part of the world, one that we don't understand very well. We don't seem to have a convergence of values with a lot of folks there. And as a result, people are thinking we're paying a high price to have the energy supply lines of our country run through that part of the world. And frankly, if you get out of the Middle East, which would be hard to do, but even if we were to, then you'd be dependent on a whole series of other countries that are not particularly exciting points of departure for an economy, including Russia and Kazakhstan and Nigeria and Venezuela. So I think the public is ready today, and some of the polling we've been doing at the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy confirms this, is ready for an alternative energy future, ready to even pay a premium to get out from under the dependence on foreign oil that has been so damaging to us from a geostrategic point of view. And I think beyond that, the public is frustrated by high energy prices. And, this is a big pinch on the everyday person's budget. And frankly, we've got a structural imbalance now between energy supply and energy demand, with supplies of fossil fuels level and even declining, and energy demand rising rapidly as China and India and other parts of the developing world grow into modern economies. And I think that is only going to become more severe over time, and the prices are likely to go up. And the solution here is really only one of two things. It's to bring down demand, and that is done by energy efficiency. But there's a limit to how much you can bring it down. And then the real sort of solution is new sources of supply. And frankly, it's not going to be new fossil fuel sources. We just don't have a lot of new sources to tap. And despite some recent political chants of drill, baby, drill, it's quite honestly neither a short nor a long-term solution. The amount of energy available in Alaska or offshore would only serve our purposes for a small number of years, 1 or 2 years in the oil supply in Alaska, 3 or 4 for the offshore reserves. And frankly, there aren't a lot of pieces of equipment ready to go and explore this and exploit it. So it'll probably take us 5 or 6, maybe even 7 or 8 years to get at that oil. So it's not a short-term answer either. So I think what we see is the real solution lies in alternative energy, and we're going to have to move on to a clean energy future. And I think one of the exciting things is that there's a lot of effort being put into figuring out what the best options are. And we don't know today. That's what's a fundamental reality. We don't know if solar cells will come down in cost to the point of competing in terms of electricity generation with burning coal. We don't know if wind power could come down in cost and be competitive. But again, people are exploring these options and a dozen other ways to get the energy future of our country moved onto a new clean energy platform.
Can you talk a little bit about how carbon credits work? Are they a good solution?
Carbon credits are kind of an interim step to help us move toward clean energy. And the carbon credit market is basically got two elements, a mandatory carbon credit structure for those that are facing regulatory requirements that they reduce emissions. And this is the case, of course, in Europe, where the European Union has adopted the Kyoto Protocol and is implementing it, in part with a carbon credit structure. And what they've done there is to require that companies bring down emissions to a certain level. And if they can't cost effectively do that, they don't have energy efficiency investments they can make that will really bring them to their target in a cost effective way, they can go out into the carbon marketplace and pay for carbon offsets, pay someone else to bring down emissions somewhere else. And that marketplace that's developed largely in London, but using the European Union regulatory structure as a framework, has now gotten to the point of being quite big and quite robust, albeit that there were some difficulties in the first couple of years. There was not a sufficient structure of regulation around these projects that were bringing down emissions. So people were paying money for carbon offsets. And then in some cases, the supposed project to reduce emissions elsewhere wasn't happening, or at least it wasn't being verified that the emissions reductions were real. So you do need always, when you have a market structure of regulation, a market-based approach, to ensure that you've got verification and certification that what is being done is real. And I think we now have a market with a much higher degree of authenticity to it, with the kind of verifications needed to be confident that when people pay someone else to reduce emissions, that the credit or the offset, as we sometimes call it, is real and is happening. There is, in the United States, a voluntary carbon market. There's no regulatory requirement here, but some number of companies and some number of individuals are paying to offset their carbon emissions. I pay, for example, for carbon credits for every flight I take. And I do this through a company called TerraPass, that is San Francisco based, and what they do is to take my money and invest in new energy sources, clean energy sources, that will then offset the need for burning coal or other fossil fuels. And what I like about my small effort to lean into the carbon wind, as it might be said, is that I am helping to put capital into the innovation process, helping to provide a mechanism for testing out and trying out some of these clean energy options. So I feel good about the money I put in. It's small, but with a lot of other people. It's funding wind power exploration. It's funding a capture of methane from pig farms. Turns out methane is a very severe greenhouse gas, 23 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So to capture that methane from those pigs and to burn it turns out to be a very useful thing to do. So I think while it's not a solution, it's at least a step in the right direction. And for those who are worried that it's somehow kind of like an indulgence where you're paying to have your sin absolved, that's not quite the right way to look at it. It really is an opportunity to begin to prime the pump of innovation and help provide some initial funding for some of the technology breakthroughs that we're going to need in the coming years.
This podcast featuring Professor Dan Esty was produced on October 9th, 2008 at the Yale Law School.